Okay. First of all, I have to share one quick anecdote about the gentleman on the far left, Bill Kittredge. It was 33 years ago when I took Bill Kittredge's creative writing class here at the university. I had virtually no life experiences coming from a pretty sheltered existence in Michigan. And I was trying to write a short story, and it was pretty bland. And I'm listening to Bill, and he's just riffing on all kinds of things, Glacier Park and going hikes in the wilderness and what makes a good story. So I went back, and I put women in it, I put booze in it, I put fights in it, and I think I got a B. Anyway, it's a good thing that I chose, that I stuck with the journalism school. Okay, so Brian DeSalvatore is the author of A Clever Baseballist, I'm sorry, The Life and Times of John Montgomery Ward, as well as many articles for magazines such as The New Yorker, where I've read him, New York Times Magazine and more. He teaches nonfiction writing at the University of Montana, and he has generously agreed to moderate this panel. So I'll let him take it from here. Thank you.
Welcome to Breakfast with the Authors. Lizzie Grossman sends her regrets via Bandung in Indonesia, where she is attending a meeting of Asian NGOs on environmental health and occupational health issues. She called it a one-off occasion, an infelicitous phrase for a difficult choice. You're stuck with me. I'm going to be, as you guys are journalists, terse, tight, and telegraphic. Briefly and probably unnecessarily introduce all three of these folks. They will read or talk for about 15 minutes, and then we'll take questions, which I think is often the most productive part of these sorts of things. Bill Kittredge, Regent Professor of Creative Writing, my mentor about five wars ago. Author of Hole in the Sky, Who Owns the West, Nature of Generosity, Owning It All, and We Are Not in This Together, and which I suspect is what you guys are most familiar with. I would like to direct you to his fiction, including The Van Gogh Field, the best short stories of William Kittredge by Grey Wolf, and wonderfully, and his novel, Willow Fields, because I think we won't get into what I think, but there's more truth often in fiction than nonfiction, which I've spent my life writing. And wonderfully, he is 200 pages into a new novel. David James Duncan, author of Brothers K, River Y, River Teeth, My Story is Told by Water, and God Laughs and Plays. He also is working on another novel called Eastern Western. Kathleen Dean Moore, welcome to Missoula. She's from Oregon State, professor of philosophy, author of River Walking, Hold Fast, Pine Island Paradox, and others. So, first up, Bill Kittredge.
Thank you, Brian. Is this thing working? Can you hear me? I'll start trouble right off. I'm one of those people who doesn't believe there's any such thing as nonfiction. So, hope that makes you... Journalists don't want to hear that ever. I have an old argument about it, but I'm not going to get into it. Years ago, I wrote these sentences. Our old pilgrims believed in stories in which the West was a promise, a place where decent people could escape the wreckage of failed lives and start over. Come along, the dream whispers, and you can have another chance. This time, we'll get it right. The West was a gift for the taking, the fruited plain, a paradise of animals, Purple Mountain's majesty, and a fresh new land, the last best place, a psychic treasure, an ongoing dream of possibility. But why in a story about a promised land do we have to hear about taking? That's another story, time-honored, about conquest and colonization, an antique story about manifest destiny and subjugation. Versions of that old story featuring explosions, broken glass, and weaponry, and occasional cocaine play on television every night. We can't seem to give up on the glories. We know how it played in the Old West, about mountain men, how they exterminated the beaver, and how the California gold miners polluted the rivers with the tailings of hydraulic mining, and how the buffalo hunters managed to kill 50 or 60 million of those creatures, and how transcontinental railroads exploited the Asians who built them, and how the great rivers were dammed and the forests were decimated, and the part about the poison left behind by hard rock miners, and the wreckage that followed under petroleum drilling and strip mining the prairies, and the part about federal bombing ranges. Many don't want to hear about them anymore. Out here in flyover country, we're sick of such stories, and we're sickened by them. We live within a web of physical and psychic scars. For openers, simple manifestations like highways and power lines traced against the landform. But those scars are also traced on our collective psyche, like a palimpsest of ruinous tattoos detailing the social and environmental wounding left after our never-ending scramble after wealth. Again and again, terrific commercial notions turned out to be disastrous in the long run. But local politics in the West are still deeply wedded to the old conquest story. Why didn't we abandon it? Why can't we give it up even now? Why are our politicians given to dressing their policies up in ways that are so incessantly cowboy? The boys go for Stetson hats, bolo ties, and snakehide boots. Maybe it's because matters of class loom so large in Western minds. No politician wants to be accused of elitism. At the same time, so many Western senators have been sons of ruling class ranchers. Thank God, since populations in the interior West are over 80% urban, that particular tradition is beginning to fracture. I have to interrupt myself and say that the two best politicians we've had in Montana, in my book, are Mike Mansfield and Pat Williams. Both of them are from Butte, and they started off as teachers and not cowboys, or particularly not ruling class ranchers. People always say, why are you opposed to, you know, the cow business? And I said, it's sort of like miners and mine owners, isn't it? You know, cowboys are not like ranchers. Ranchers are a whole other breed of cat, you know. I grew up in one of the biggest cattle ranches in Oregon. I can tell this one by heart. Anyway, the West is a mixture of enclaves and neighborhoods, each with their own defining stories. Go to Vegas and rural Utah, casinos and remote sheep ranches, operas in Santa Fe and the sad and murderous squalor not so far south on the Mexican border. You'll encounter media celebrities and endless retirees and wealthy folks all looking for a place to hide out, a place where they can feel grounded, and thank God many of them do. There's a lot to revere about the Great West. But you'll also hear stories that detail the ways disenfranchised Westerners survive tough times by being tough enough. It's easy to feel out of the action, left behind and out of the loop. It's tempting to turn bitter and sour. Leave us alone, goes the implied story. We'll get by, always have. Such folks sometimes want to get even and even vote. Politicians respond to their hostility and endorse a story that was and often is socially and environmentally disastrous. It's the same ancient and angry and irresponsible story, racist, sexist, and homophobic. It's that bad anyway. Go to Reserve, a little town in Catron County, New Mexico. Check out Uncle Billy's bar, which has been called the State House of Redneck Anger. You'll feel hostility in that tavern, where locals advocate absolute independence in a world that can't afford it anymore. I went in and didn't finish my bud. I was wearing Birkenstocks, manufactured in some foreign place. As a consequence, I guess they thought I was alien. The West wants to be its own independent country, but it's not. We're utterly dependent on world and national economies. Without outside money, we'd be shut down worse than we are. In that sense, we're all out of the loop. It might be why Montana and Wyoming are so voraciously intent on harvesting their energy sources. How else can they get in on the national and international action? What to do? We should think up a new story. 1963 in Eastern Oregon, the Beatles on Ed Sullivan were like news from the moon. Ideas of what to expect were dissolving. This was evident in a passing generation. I hired and fired men who survived the Depression because they could do scrupulous work, combine men and diesel mechanics. But they were growing old and dying in the bunkhouses. Eventually, I couldn't hire men who cared about their tasks. No women applied. Ranch work was a way to miss all the boats. Those who took our jobs despised themselves for being down to this. Simultaneously, by 1971, when the 448-page Whole Earth Catalog won the National Book Award, a new American story was being worked out. It centered on fairness and living local, working in cooperation with rather than in opposition to ecosystems. Popularized by Westerners like Gary Snyder, Wallace Stegner, and Ed Abbey, such thinking connected citizens who were eager to work out ideas they could believe in, dedicated to fairness and preserving nature. It seemed like the old Western mythology, the conquest and colonialism story, was being replaced by a new story about taking care and generosity. And to a considerable degree, it was and has. It goes on evolving while we become more and more cosmopolitan. Stockbrokers relocate to Wyoming, trading on New York exchanges in the morning and fishing the streams after the markets close at 2 p.m. their time. Oilfield roughnecks steal secondhand Mercedes on eBay. Hard-handed women and men summer in Alaska and fly south to surf the winter away in the Mediterranean climate of Western Australia. Ranchers read the New York Times on their computers and mull their responsibilities to society. As members of the culture that descended from folks who cooked up the style in the Whole Earth Catalog, they, some of them, learned to believe in moral duty, social justice, and environmental preservation. A primary connection between them centers on a sense that we inhabit a commons. We have common laws in the Grand Canyon and Sandhill cranes congregating on the Platte River, and free speech, and all the big sacred world. All have to be maintained and protected. We cannot allow individuals or corporations or governments to degrade them. So here we are, how to create an economy that responds to present-day realities rather than those of the past, how to persuade corporations, entities serving an ethos of endless selfishness, to take part in the redoing of our economy, how to answer demands for energy while making sure the petroleum and coal extraction industries don't ruin natural systems, how to mitigate the oncoming evident changes of global warming. World cultures endure a crisis in matters of fairness. Can we provide for those left behind? All the disenfranchised? Will we share our wealth? Can we do all these things at the same time? Can I turn the page? Almost over. The West I grew up in was inflexible because of that irresponsible. My parents were intent on preserving their status and prerogatives, their privileges. Citizens who base ethical judgments on rigid doctrines are mostly dysfunctional. They have abandoned their responsibility to work out problems for themselves. Blinded by concepts, this goes for both radicals and conservatives. Some become rigid, dogmatic, true believers. Can we, the most privileged national population in history, take care and stay generous? Or is that just a pretty dream? This time, can we get it right? Thank you. Thank you very much.
The English language is a wonderful thing when it's treated well. Kathleen.
Oh, thank you. Excuse me. It's really fun to be here. You guys are so much more fun than, say, the meetings of the American Philosophical Association. Yeah, is that damning with faint praise? Also, you know stuff, and that's cool. Very cool. So I'm from the Pacific Northwest. I'm from Oregon. Yeah. Are you here with me? We're not proud or anything, are we? Yeah, so this is, I'm from the valley of the Willamette River, which is this powerful river that flows north between, on the east side, these iconic glacier-streaked volcanoes, and on the west side, the bare-ass hillsides of the clear-cut Coast Range. The pioneers called the Willamette Valley, where I live, the Garden of Eden. And I think in many ways it is the Garden of Eden, assuming that the Garden of Eden is foggy and has a lot of traffic. But we do have apple trees, lots of apple trees, like the Garden of Eden, and not as many snakes as before. But never mind that. Here from Oregon is my view of the answers that we've been given, to the questions that we've been given. Remember in the program it says, this is not your grandparents' West. What are the world's most pressing and salient issues? What does one tell, how does one tell and get these stories out in the current publishing landscape? So no, it's not our grandparents' West. In fact, it's our grandchildren's West, to be perfectly honest. And how, in God's name, are we going to make the good decisions that we have to about the kind of world that we're going to leave in the West for our children? That seems to me, journalists, to be the big story. In Oregon, as in everywhere else, we've got this climate destabilization, we've got the environmental degradation that are affecting all of us. In Oregon, we also have a history of reckless resource extraction. I guess that's no surprise. And it's probably not a surprise that we also have this history of irascibility in Oregon, right? Nobody is going to tell us what to do. And that translates into a kind of quirky creativity sometimes. That's good, because we're going to need all the creativity we can muster. And I oftentimes think, if we can't stop the stupidity in Oregon, this land of milk and honey, can we stop it anywhere? So, in Oregon, climate changes are going to put great new stresses on all of our systems. They're going to stress the hydrological systems beyond imagining. I was up in the Skagit River at their great celebration. They were so happy that they had restored all 5 salmon to the Skagit River. And I was listening to the drums, and I was listening to the speeches, and I looked up to see that those rivers are fed by glaciers that will not exist in 20 years. And then where would those salmon swim? It's going to put new stresses on our food systems. It's going to put new stresses on our transportation systems. But what concerns me the most is that it's going to put terrible stresses on our ethical systems. Are our ethical systems robust enough to stand up to this pressure? Are our convictions about justice strong enough to move us to change a way of life that's manifestly unjust? The ways in which we live our profligate, comfortable lives, taking all the benefits of our use of the energy and shove off all the burdens on people who are not in a position to speak in their own defense. People in the North and the South, but particularly people in the future. Are our convictions, is our commitment to equal rights strong enough to withstand the pressure that's going to occur when people from insufferably hot places in, say, Arizona start moving into our valleys? What then is going to happen to our view of equal rights? And what if their misery is caused by their own profligacy? What will we think about equal rights then? What's going to happen to our notion of equal rights when they start asking for our water? And can we even imagine the demands on our feelings of compassion as drought destroys the agricultural systems of places like many places in the southern hemisphere, and diseases spread up without surcease? And so even as we redesign the food systems, even as we think about how to remove the stresses on the hydrological systems, even as we think about ways to beef up our transportation system, the message that I want to give to you journalists today is that we need to be creating a huge national, global conversation about our obligations to the future and beefing up also our ethical system. So that's the first point that I want to make. This is the message from Oregon, that climate change is a scientific problem, climate change is a technological problem, but primarily, climate change is a moral problem. And to take what we need for our blessed, comfortable lives and leave a degraded, ransacked, destabilized world for our progeny That's not worthy of us as moral beings. And then we have an affirmative moral obligation to the future to leave a world that's as rich in possibility as our own. We talk about science. You people are doing a heroic job with the science. And we talk about the technology. But we don't talk enough about our moral obligations. And I think that's a disastrous silence. I think it's a huge, disastrous, terrible silence. And that's the second point that I want to make. And I'm glad for the chance to talk to journalists. Because what I want to say is that knowledge is not enough. It's not true that if people knew, if they only knew, then they would act. Of course, I just read a poll that said a significant portion of Americans think that we could solve the climate change problem if our jet planes would quit poking holes in the ozone layer. So, yeah, you guys have plenty of work to do. And and it's really important to do that work. We need a base level of knowledge and education about our challenges. But that's not enough. You know, the scientists and you all have done this heroic job. But it's not the case that if people knew, they would act. To think that is a logical error. So if you'd give me just a second, I want to talk about syllogisms. You probably knew that if you gave a philosopher the microphone, you'd have to listen to something about syllogism. But here's the deal. Any argument that has as a conclusion a statement about what we ought to do is going to have two premises. The first premise is empirical. It's scientific. It's descriptive. This is the way the world is. But you can't get from a description of the way the world is to a statement about what we ought to do without a second premise. And that second premise is normative. It's ethical. It's a vision of what a good life is. It's a vision of what's worthy of us as moral beings. It's a vision of our sense of values and how we can embody those in our actions. Neither of those alone will get us to a conclusion about what we ought to do. Both of them together will. If this is the way the world is, if our actions are going to bring harm to the future, as the scientists tell us, and second premise, if it's wrong to harm the future, needlessly, thoughtlessly, it's wrong, then it follows, doesn't it, from those two premises that we ought to take action. But the point that I want to make is that once the first premise is established, which you're doing a beautiful job on, and once the second premise is established about our obligations, which we have a lot of work to do, then we cannot deny the conclusion that action's required without abandoning our view that we are moral people. So I've been thinking very differently about my work in the world. You know, I'm a nature writer. But I can't anymore write about Frog Song and celebrate Frog Song while it just disappears. And I can't talk about the comfort that marshes provide us, even while they're buried under Kmart parking lots. And I can't pretend to my students, as you can't pretend to your readers, that science and ethics are separate realms that that deserve to be in separate departments or in separate pieces of the newspaper. That's an invitation to irresponsibility. The message is that science, the science that we're learning, has extraordinary moral consequences. So my colleague and I embarked on this project, and I wanted to call it to your attention. We asked 100 of the world's moral leaders if we have an obligation to the future to leave a world as rich in possibilities as our own, and we got back the most extraordinary response from these moral leaders, including our friend David James Duncan. Do we have an obligation to the future? Yes, for the sake of the children. Yes, because justice demands it. Yes, because compassion calls us to care. Yes, because we are called to care for God's creation. Yes, because we owe a duty of gratitude. On and on, this great outpouring of moral reasons of why we should act. And the way I think is that solving this crisis is going to take the very best science, and it's going to take very clever technology. But it's going to take the greatest exercise of the moral imagination that the world has ever seen. And it isn't going to be enough to just use our analytical minds or our observing and experimenting minds. We're going to have to call on all the powers of the human mind, the parts of the mind that celebrate and grieve and regret and imagine, the parts of our minds that question, and especially the parts of our minds that care about this world and about our children, even if it breaks our hearts. So let me just conclude by reading a four-minute piece from here. This is the piece that I contributed. It's called The Angelus, The Call to Forgiveness at the End of the Day. So here you get it from Oregon. Dateline, Wren, Oregon, May 25th, 2025. So you can imagine that I am writing this report as a very elderly woman looking back on what happened in those 15 years between now and then. All those years, the Swainson's thrushes were the first to call in the mornings. Their songs spiraled like mist from the swale to the pink sky. That's when I would take a cup of tea and walk into the meadow. Swallows sat on the highest perches, whispering as they waited for light to stream onto the pond. For years, there were flocks of goldfinches. After my husband and I poisoned the bull thistles on the far side of the pond, the goldfinches perched in the willows, shaking dew from the branches into the pond. The garbage truck backed down the lane, beeping its backup call, making the frogs sing even in the day. I don't know how many frogs there were in the pond then. Thousands, tens of thousands. Clumps of eggs like eyeballs in aspic. Neighborhood children poked them with sticks to watch their jelly shake. When the eggs hatched, there were tadpoles. I have seen the shallow edge of the pond black with wiggling tadpoles. There were that many, each with a song growing inside it. In the years when the frog choruses began to fade, scientists said it was a fungus, or maybe bullfrogs were eating the tadpoles. No one knew what to do about the fungus, but people tried to stop the bullfrogs. Standing on the dike, my neighbor shot frogs with a pellet gun, embedding silver BBs in their heads, a dozen holes, until she said, "How many holes can I make in a frog's face before it dies? Give me something more powerful." So she took a shotgun and filled the bullfrogs with buckshot, until legs snapped, faces caved in, they slowly sank away. Ravens belled from the top of the oak. When the bats stopped coming, they said that was a fungus too. When the goldfinches came in pairs, not flocks, we told each other the flocks must be feeding in a neighbor's field. No one could guess where the thrushes had gone. Two springs later, there were drifts of tiny white skins scattered in the shallows like dust rags in the dusk. I scooped one up with a stick. It was a frog skin, a perfect empty sack, white intact but with no frog inside, cleaned, I suppose, by snails or winter, and not just one. Empty frogs scattered on the muddy bottom of the pond. They were as empty as the perfect emptiness of a bell, the perfectly shaped absence ringing the Angelus, the evening song, the call for forgiveness at the end of the day. As it happened, that was the spring when our granddaughter was born. I brought her to the pond so she could feel the comfort I had known there for so many years. Killdeer waddled in the mud by the shore, but even then, not so many as before. By then, the pond had sunk into its warm, weedy places, leaving an expanse of cracked earth. I held my granddaughter in my arms and sang to her then, an old lullaby that made her soften like wax in a flame, molding her little body to my bones. Birds and the butterflies fly through the land. Go to sleep, you little baby. She fell asleep in my arms, unafraid. I will tell you, I was so afraid. Poets warned us, writing of the heartbreaking beauty that will remain when there is no heart to break for it. But what if it's worse than that? What if it's the heartbroken children who remain in a world without beauty? How will they find solace in a world without wild music? How will they thrive without green hills edged with oaks? How will they forgive us for letting frog songs slip away? It isn't enough to love a child and wish her well. It isn't enough to open my heart to a bird-graced morning. Can I claim to love a morning? Can I claim to love a child if I don't use all the power of my beating heart to preserve a world that nourishes children's joy? Loving is not a kind of la-di-da. Loving is a sacred trust. To love is to affirm the absolute worth of what you love and to pledge your life to its thriving, to protect it fiercely and faithfully for all time. Ring the Angelus for the finches and the swallows. Ring the bells for frogs floating in bent reeds. Ring the bells for all of us who did not save the songs. Mother of God, ring the bells for every sacred emptiness. Let them echo in the silence at the end of the day. Forgiveness is too much to ask. I would pray for only this, that our granddaughter would hear again that little lick of music, the grace note toward the end of a meadowlark song. Meadowlarks. There were meadowlarks. They sang like angels in the morning.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. David.
I, too, was going to fire a cannon at you this morning. I'm so glad I thought better of it. It used to be that when strangers wished to exchange a few friendly words, the safest topic was the weather. Tornadoes play peekaboo with Manhattan, polar caps, glaciers, Greenland ice fields vanish, and island nations drown beneath rising seas. A jujitsu flip has occurred in the psyches of millions. Science-minded progressives who once poo-pooed the apocalyptic ravings of, say, Jerry Falwell, now make the most gruesome doom prophecies backed by hard data. Meanwhile, apocalyptic fundamentalists cite the Gospels of Limbaugh, Beck, and Palin, unaware that they're regurgitating junk science funded by Exxon, Shell, think tanks, bribed to say global warming's a bit of mischief having nothing to do with industrial war against the Earth. Mark Twain and Ernest Hemingway saw the American schizophrenia over climate change coming a century ago. In a memorable preface, Twain once wrote, "No weather will be found in this book. This is an attempt to pull a book through without weather." In a letter to a young writer, Hemingway took the opposite position. He said, "Remember to get the weather in your goddamn book. Weather is very important." But Sam and Ernie are so masculine. Let's get a woman in here, too. How about Jane Austen? "What dreadful hot weather we have. It keeps me in a continual state of inelegance." Fellow Earth lovers, the goddamned weather has the Earth and us in a state of inelegance. And here in the Northwest and Northern Rockies, the fix is in again. Big government and bigger oil are out to turn our rivers, scenic byways, and high mountain passes into a tentacle of the Alberta tar sands, weather be damned. I thought I'd hammer that when I woke early this morning. Then I got to thinking, most of you are headed home to your lives and work days. And if I know environmental journalists, more than a few of you are a bit hung. What sense does it make, I thought early this morning, to hammer a hungover colleague who already agrees with me? Maybe mercy on a headache is a better speech than speech. There's also this: good-hearted people whose minds haven't closed are not only our best readers, they're our only real readers. Sometimes I start raving in public about, say, salmon-killing dams, then pull myself up and think, hey, Floyd Dominey's dead. Dick Cheney's almost dead. Manuel Lujan and James Watt are forgotten. Heads of state and big oil are deliberately deaf and screaming at Floyd, Dick, and the deliberately deaf only scares those I hope to touch. Isn't one of our duties as earth-loving writers to keep weary minds open and good-heartedness intact? With that thought, I decided at 5 or so this morning that much as I love the wilds under assault, I'd spend my 15 minutes of fame this morning talking about a different sort of wild entirely, the one inside us. I met the poet William Stafford in 1992 at the same instant I met William Kittredge. What a fine thing it was sitting at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland beside the two Williams. The three of us looking at each other sideways because the tables were set up like this, now and then signing a book for a Christmas shopper as we talked of obscure places in Oregon all three of us knew and loved. Here's William Stafford speaking of a place the three of us knew, the wild within. The poem's called "Why I Am Happy," and it reminds me of how I felt that day seated between the two bills. Now has come an easy time. I let it roll. There is a lake somewhere so blue and far nobody owns it. A wind comes by and a willow listens gracefully. I hear all this every summer. I laugh and cry for every turn of the world. It's terribly cold, innocent spin. That lake stays blue and free. It goes on, and I know where it is. I'd had recurring dreams of that very lake since early childhood. In the dreams, I saw it more clearly than I've seen even the most gorgeous lake I've actually hiked up to. I knew the first time I dreamed it that one day I'd find this lake. I still know it, though Stafford's poem is as close as I've come. Words like this are truly passages. You start out one place, read a passage, and bam, you've been carried somewhere else. Where? I'd say into the wild within. William Blake says, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. I guess now and then we simply forget ourselves, look out of a non-self, and see everything cleansed. Thoreau saw ponds the way Stafford saw my interior lake. Henry wrote, ponds are great crystals on the surface of the earth, lakes of light. If they were permanently congealed and small enough to be clutched, they would be carried off by slaves like precious stones to adorn the heads of emperors. But being liquid and ample and secured to us and our successors forever, we disregard them. They're too pure to have a market value. They contain no muck. The ponds I know contain a plethora of muck. I think Henry's perception, cleansed, is speaking of a pond within the wilds of himself, in which, as he himself put it, water is earth's eye, looking into which the beholder measures the depths of his own nature. Mary Oliver's half century on Cape Cod carries her into the wild interior again and again. In Redbird, she sings, not this, not that, nor anything, not the eastern wind whose other name is rain, nor the burning heats of the dunes at the crown of summer, nor the ticks, the new ferocious populace, not the president who loves blood, nor the governmental agencies that love money, will alter my love for you, my friends, and my beloved, or for you, O ghosts of Emerson and Whitman, or for you, O blue sky of a summer morning that makes me roll in a barrel of gratitude down hills, or for you, oldest of friends, hope, or for you, newest of friends, faith, or for you, silliest and dearest of surprises, my own life. D.H. Lawrence, late in his own life, from New Mexico. I am part of the sun as my eyes are part of me. That I am part of the earth, my feet know perfectly of me. That I am part of the earth, my feet know perfectly, and my blood is part of the sea. There is nothing of me that is alone and absolute except my mind, and we shall find that the mind has no existence by itself. It is only the glitter of the sun on the surface of the waters. That Lawrence quote is on the wall of Jim Harrison's study. Not coincidentally, no Montanan has written of the door that opens from the wilds of this world into the wilds of the inner more eloquently than Jim. From a suite of poems all titled River, here's River Number 7, Jim Harrison. The last trip to the river this year. Tonight I think of the trout swimming in a perfect moonless dark, navigating in the current by the tiny pinpoint of stars, night wind rippling the eddies, and, if you stick your head under, the slight sound of pebbles rubbing pebbles. Today I saw two dead white pelicans. I heard their shot because they eat trout. Crows shot because they eat duck eggs. Wolves shot for eating elk or for chasing a bicyclist in Yellowstone. Should we be shot for for eating the world and giving back our puke? Yeah. I need Jim's voice to get me through this. Way down in Notch Bottom, ancient winter camp of long-gone Indians, I'm sweetly consoled by man's absolute absence except for a stretch of fence on the riverbank, half washed away and a sequence of no trespassing signs. The river can't heal everything. You have to do your part. We've even bruised the moon. Still, the birds are a chorus with a moving flow. Relatives of Mozart, the brown trout so lovely the heart flutters. Back home, something is eaten, the unfledged swallows. It wasn't me. I'm on another river now, swollen and turbulent. The spirit is here. Are you? I ask myself. What sort of experiences lead to such passages? Clear sight, memory, dream, reflection, and repetition. Yeah, repetition, leading not to boredom, but to a familiarity that takes on the quality of liturgy. Mary Oliver walks her dunes a couple hundred times a year. Jim Harrison floats his rivers 100 times a year. Repetition leads to real and dream lakes, real and dream rivers. Why are the feelings expressed so similar despite the differences in people and place? And if we too want to experience such passages, is there a ticket we can buy? Do National Geographic or Sierra offer field trips to Stafford's Lake or to Cape Cod, where they loan you a barrel and roll you in gratitude down Mary O's dunes? Afraid not? And why not? Because the truth is too wonderful to reach via field trip. The kingdom of heaven is within you. America's broken political system, its government by corporate lobbyists, its talk radio and talk television and blogging industries produce a torrent of overwrought preachments I feel commanded by frequent sneak attacks of spirit and joy to almost entirely ignore. Preachments have bombarded good souls for so long that droves of us now flee any article, book, blog, building, or conference that might expose us to a fresh skein of cocksure, overheated words. So I try to freight my own saddest stories, even my continual inelegance over the weather, with intimations of the interior wild. It's an overlooked duty of everyone driven by love of earth to provide not just cries of warning, but gasps of delight. Not just righteous anger, but righteous humor. Not just screed, but the solace and refuge of invisible lakes. The wild within, like national parks, like Idaho's and Montana's wilderness and rivers, enfranchises everyone. Pico Iyer. We cannot truly tend to our polluted waters, shrinking forests, the madness we've loosed on the air till we begin to clean up the inner waters and attend to the embattled wild spaces within. Paul, Valerie, there is another world, but it is in this one. Jim Harrison, there is an invisible world out there, and we're living in it. In the name of that world, I'll end with a poem just penned with the oiled and dead pelican feather quill of my old friend Tom Crawford, who loves Montana like a local and from New Mexico, has been following our new crisis. Tom is rarely prompt about anything, but via love's own timing, he sent this poem, as its title demands, last week on Columbus Day. Christopher Columbus discovers the tar sands of Alberta. How did it happen? He got so far inside us. You shave, and he still grows back as wilderness caved in under the iron shoes of his horses. the rumble we hear now, the coming of giant modules on flatbeds down our roads, assaulting our towns, our families. They're not in the stars, dear reader, but in ourselves. And what's this new plan 500 years later once they crawl their way to Alberta on the Mamowets? We're going to build a fire, then we're going to cook the earth till it pukes its oil. And if we have to, that's right, you're in the kitchen on this one. I mean, if we have to, we'll deep fry 160 million waterfowl and songbirds in their summer nurseries and nesting grounds. How to save what's left? Hard work. You'll have to pull the Columbus in you out from behind the wheel, America. All good poems are hard work. They say, change your life. Change your life. Thank you.
I tell my students that whatever the project at hand is, whether it's an article, a poem, a novel, a short story, an essay, you need to cross a stream. You need to get to the other shore. And often the best way is not a bridge, but to cross it on the cobbles. And sometimes you have to take giant steps onto a big, sturdy rock, and sometimes you have to go tip, 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 tip out on little bitty teetery rocks. But you do get to the other side, and I think that's what we have here. I mean, Bill talking about old dreams, savage dreams that perhaps are going to be reinvented if we're lucky, and we probably won't be. Moral clothes in which we swaddle ourselves to remain alive, and finishing up with the all-star infield of Ernest Hemingway, Jim Harrison, Mark Twain, and at first base, Jane Austen, the first gal ever to play Major League Ball. I had a question for these guys to start, guys and gals to start this off, but I think I was saying, Jesus, they're journalists. That's all they do is ask questions. So I'm going to forget mine. And all I do want to ask that you stand, identify yourself briefly, and your newspaper, your affiliation, your organization briefly, and ask a brief question rather than present an oration. Okay? And I don't know, I don't think there is such a thing as a shy journalist, so who has a question for these folks? Yes. What should we be thinking about managing our human population footprint?
I'll quote my friend Tom Spombauer, use a rubber.
How about sub that up?
Anyone else?
Sometimes that the only people to respond to your writing are, you know, really touched by your writing are sort of
So which books, if there are any, have gone beyond preaching to the choir, environmental books, and we are eliminating Silent Spring?
Silent Spring changed my life. I was doing all the, I was farming in Warner Valley in southeastern Oregon. In Silent Spring, she talks about the second chapter, environmental practices that were killing all the waterfowl in Klamath Basin, which is about 100 miles straight west of us, in which we were doing all the, we had exactly the same ecological setup, and we were doing all the same things. We once sprayed parathion on for clover mite in the barley. We killed every water bird, or every bird in the valley, which was about 40 miles long and 20 miles wide. And I was in the midst of doing all that, and I thought I was doing God's work. I was raising food for people. I was a good farmer doing all that, and I realized I was not doing God's work. And I will say Silent Spring changed my life, and I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for reading Silent Spring in 1962. I'll shut up on that, but it's true.
In answer to the question, I've had better luck with fiction than with nonfiction, especially nonfiction that names political figures or religious leaders. And I don't have a problem with preaching to the choir. I think almost every good thing that's been done in this country has been done by a choir and not by, industry toadies. It's really pitiful to be having a conversation and all of a sudden know that you're getting regurgitated Beck or Limbaugh, and I just won't do it. I'll say, if you have a thought, I'm interested in hearing it, but don't regurgitate what you've been listening to on Smash Mouth Radio. That's not a conversation. There's a lot of Republicans in Montana. A lot of them are my neighbors. I have a Republican friend who is a former North Dakota wheat rancher. He has the biggest goddamn trout in his pond. I cannot stay away from that man. And we've learned to converse. It's a really, the question that was asked is a really serious question. If anybody else has more thoughts, it's how to break down. There's received thought. There's so many people, they're like sea anemones. They've had too much information wash over them, and they've chosen to close. And when I'm talking to a closed person, I recognize it right away, and usually I just stop talking. And I find that those people will often be touched by a work of fiction, but not by a real straight-ahead piece of activist writing.
It's hard to talk about it. Czesław Miłosz, the great Polish poet who won the Nobel Prize, died at 100 fairly recently. About 50 years ago, wrote a book called The Captive Mind about politics in Eastern Europe and communism, and essentially the evolution of true believers. And there's a great book called The True Believer by Stevedore in San Francisco. It was published about 19... Eric Hoffer. About, again, closed minds. And I think books about closed minds, like Czesław Miłosz and Eric Hoffer, those are really useful books for us to look at and think about and try to address yourself to closed minds and how to open them in some kind of way or another without just attacking.
And I would say a word also for preaching to the choir. The people in the choir, like so many people in the church, are hypocrites. And if those of us who really did believe that climate change was a problem and that environmental degradation was a sin, as most people in church did, acted in accordance with those beliefs, then maybe we would have some sort of change. So that's one reason to sing to the choir. And the other is that they need some help. They need strength. They need to be reminded why the work is so important. But let me just say one thing about Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson was so powerful because she combined three abilities. She had a strong science background. She had a clear moral vision, and she wrote like an angel. So none of us have those three characteristics, but any three of us do. So I've been going around the country arguing that we need Rachel Carson trios. that none of us can work alone, but any three of us could do this together.
Yeah, that's a great idea. That's just, that's exactly this activist book that I'm writing with Rick Bass, trying to stop Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana from becoming a tentacle of the tar sands, connecting the tar sands directly to the Pacific Rim industrial nations, China, South Korea, which our governor loves this plan. We pulled in a science writer, a fantastic photographer, and Rick and I have very different skills. So it's really, there's four of us, but it's kind of what Kathleen's talking about, different skill set.
Red shirt there.
There is power in grief. I'm not sure we need to, as writers, feel that we need to move quickly away from a place of grief. And when we were listening to the newscasts coming out of New Orleans, some of them probably yours, that was what we writers were saying to each other, is how can we harness the power of grieving? I think that that doesn't help you very much at this point, but I think it's an important thing to think about as writers.
I don't know. I lived in New Orleans for about 6 months, about 10 years ago, and I was struck by the fact that it was most gleeful and saddest place I had simultaneously that I ever lived. There was a schoolyard execution, one child shooting another one in the head, once a week, every week we were there, at least. I also never heard so much laughing and happiness and jolliness, you know, up and down the streets and around and about. So I don't know what to make of that. I always marveled at it. But I realized the oppression is really hard to live with. I wrote a little piece about Sunday morning. It was raining. Anik and I were out walking down a street. The shutters are all pulled. And I hear this voice far off singing, "Glory, glory, hallelujah." I go around a corner. There's a young black woman standing there with a coffee can at her feet, and collecting dollar bills from people passing by. I went over and I put a dollar bill in it, and I realized later that woman's not going to stand there forever singing glory, glory, hallelujah with a coffee can at her feet collecting dollar bills. You know, eventually that's going to tell on her spirit. She's probably already had, and tell on the spirit of a whole people, but they're tough. God bless them. But
we're all interested in writing.
And you are?
And many of us either write fiction also or dabble. And I'd like you before you to give me your thoughts on the future of the book fiction industry and creative writing departments. Creative writing departments are booming now. Yes, the book industry itself is going through a bloodbath similar to journalism's bloodbath. And what will emerge?
Okay, a few words on the future of literature.
I'm right in the middle of it right now. I'm sitting home up here in Missoula. I got 150 novels on my dining room table, and I got another 175 coming. I'm reading for the Penn Faulkner. I've done it before, and you end up reading 320, or going through, not necessarily reading. You know, somebody said, "How can you read all those books?" I said, "Well, you don't. For Christ's sake." I said, "You're not trying to rank the list. You're just trying to pick a winner, you know." And once in a while, it's like any year. There aren't very many really terrific novels. The one I'm reading right now is about Democracy in America. What's his name?
Franson.
What?
Franson?
No. Just Tocqueville. An Australian writer living in New York writing about Tocqueville in America. And it's terrific. It's a wonderful book. But I've read actually till clear to the end of about 30 of them. Some have been pretty good, but nothing's been terrific. But if you look back at the lists from 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the prize winners, all this sort of thing, the best, you won't find very many. In other words, there's not many As I Lay Dying's out there. You know, any given year, there's probably not any. You know, and so I tend to be pretty optimistic and think maybe things aren't changing all that much, although maybe they're selling less. You look at what's coming out of Hollywood or what's on television, and you certainly would think something's gone haywire with American storytelling or world storytelling. I don't know. Beyond that, I'll shut up.
I have gotten to the point where I do not read nonfiction beyond the sports pages and book reviews very much. I am just overloaded, and speaking to New Orleans, I mean, the world is clearly a superating mess. I take some comfort, and I did this in my research in the 19th century. It was then a superating mess, and it was in 1500 and probably 200 AD. It's just that the superation is coming from a different part of the body. But I am blissfully removing myself from this century. And without apology, I mean, you know, look, we have people here doing it. I'm a simple guy reading fiction and enjoying it and abdicating my moral responsibility. Dave?
I'm trying to remember the part of your question about, you asked about the future of MFA programs, writing, creative writing programs.
How will people make a living in fiction writing?
That's funny.
Well, I've often thought if I just toured the country with the Social Security sends you a list of your income since you became a wage earner. If I just went from MFA program to program, showing the students that, I could shut down MFA programs all over the country.
I don't know, David. I don't think so. I think it's always been. How much money do you make writing? 99 yeah. people out of 100, none. I've been writing for 12 years. I got my first $50. You know? What was I doing? I was out of my mind.
Yeah. I mowed lawns for a living for 8 years, finally sold a short story to North American Review, got $30. But a cop pulled me over because my license plate was expired. So I got the letter out and said, look, I just sold my first short story, $30. He said, oh, the fine's $30. I'll let you go. And I said, so I actually got to keep my $30.
So the pen is mightier than the sword, right?
I think one of the things that I'm always impressed by is the fact that we live in two ethical systems, one of which is among people, perhaps people like this, but at least with your friends and close friends, your family, you know, humans evolved in bands of 30 to 50. We're good, we're kind, we take care, we do all those things. But on the other hand, when we go downtown to buy a car, we're living in another ethical system, completely different. And the trouble is that question mixes those two systems just as intricately as possible. People want to do good. They want to write stories they love. They want to tell the truth. They want to do all those things, but they also want to get paid. I remember when Terry McDonald started Rocky Mountain Magazine. Maybe the biggest check I'd ever had was $50. And I wrote a piece for him called Redneck Secrets, and he paid me $750 for about 3,500 pages, or 3,500 words. And I thought, holy I thought, this is terrific. I didn't realize it could be this good. So I think those two systems mix, and I think they mix in our moral conjunctions all the time and confuse us all the time. You know, there's doing good, and then there's making a living or getting rich or whatever the hell it is you want, or getting a lot of prestige or something.
At our university, the English department, with its MFA program and so forth, is being merged into a larger department that we are calling environmental leadership, one program, or humanities, another program. And what I think is a very good thing is that that rather than thinking of the English department as monolithic or isolated or introspective, we're really inviting those programs to find ways to integrate with the rest of the university, to call students to a kind of integration of knowledge so that they can't think that science and ethics, for example, are separated, that the writers also are being called, I think, to an integration of knowledge that will help people, you know, in the old way of saying it, connect the dots. So maybe there's a future, but it might be different.
Yes. Could you repeat that?
I think the one that touched me most deeply was an article that was written by Thomas Friedman. And he was quoting a young girl, she was 12 years old, her name was Severin Suzuki. She was speaking at the Rio convention. And what she said is that you tell us that we are what we do, not what we say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. So I think that the voices of the children that are being heard in these essays are very, very strong. So that's what spoke to me most clearly. As to the politicians' ethics, I really can't. I have no clue.
I'm looking for a hand here. No. The exit is to your left, yeah. Okay. Yes.
Jeff Olson, National Park Service, Public Affairs, Recovery Journalism. Not a question, but I work with journalists all the time, and I work with young people coming up, and I work with a lot of people in government. So I wanted to thank each of you, for not ending a single sentence with a preposition.
Yes. You are?
I'm Joe Davis. I work for SJ. I'm on my own here. My question is this. You guys have so much to say, and actually some of my colleagues in the room here who are writing or have written books or wrote a book in the left already, they have a lot to say too. Books are a really important medium, doing a job, much of the job that journalism needs to do, I think. But my question is, we live in a, call it a media sphere, where your friend Rush Limbaugh is really dominating the airwaves because of the way the U.S. media is set up. And I worry, and I want to hear your response to this worry, that voices like yours, intelligent, deep, with a moral dimension, aren't being heard in our society because of the way the media are. And what do you think about that, and what can we do about it if we want to do anything about it?
So I guess the question is, the loud voices are pervasive and effectively you guys are rivulets in an ocean or toward an ocean. So is this new? Is this old? You just throw up your hands? What?
I think it's new. I think the founding fathers were pretty specific about the requirements of democracy. Education was huge, and We now have gigantic ignorance dispensing machines, and that's new. Also, there's 7 billion people. There were 1.3 billion in 1900. That's new. Also, the Mormons are doing really well, you know. What's that about, you know? Low-quality information, you know, lowest common denominator thought will always have, I think, will always have greater numbers than high-quality thought. That's something, you know, Robert Bly talked about that for 30 years. Well, I'm really old-fashioned. I'm a student of the great wisdom traditions, and when I read any of my six translations of the Bhagavad Gita or the Upanishads or the Sutras or the Gospels, I lose concern about low, you know, common denominator knowledge and just trust that I'm a pissant, I'm not in charge, but neither is frickin' Rush Limbaugh, you know. And, I mean, there's a really beautiful argument in War and Peace where Tolstoy talks about how the leaders of humanity have the guy who put the burr in his ass was Napoleon. And he had a lot of rage toward Napoleon, but he finally, looking at the way the guy lived, looking at the way kings live, for me, the king that really put a lot of acid in my stomach was King George the Bush, you know, coronated by a fascist Supreme Court who now says that, you know, China can buy the next election in Montana because they're a citizen, you know. And Tolstoy's argument is that these people are like queen bees. They have no freedom, and they're going from one little cylinder in the hive. If you look at these poor figures when they go from media event to media event and read the teleprompter and are presenting no thoughts that are even their own, I really start to feel pity. I really start to feel some human pity. In fact, when I first was rereading Tolstoy's argument, I thought, you know, if George Bush walked up today and maybe grew a beard and ditched all his handlers, I might even show him where he could catch a nice fish. And then I said, fuck it. And I said, fuck it, and left my study and went back in the creek and caught a 17-inch rainbow. And I thought, that's a freedom that poor bastard, you know, just doesn't have. Another thing about George Bush that made me feel something was when he was asked for the greatest moment of the first 4 years of his presidency, he said it was catching a 7-pound perch in his farm pond in Crawford, Texas. I was like, you go, George.
I'm going to Ohio pretty soon, and where my in-laws I'll be staying with get all their news from Rush Limbaugh and Fox News, and I'll be there on Election Day. And my husband, now understand, this is his family. My husband arranged a special flight so that he could leave in the morning of Election Day and leave me there by myself. So the pity for the damn bastards, the poor bastards that I feel, it's me. I'm the one I feel so sorry for. But I have a strategy, and my strategy is going to say, I'm not going to talk about anything except what you most deeply value. And we will find common ground on that, and then I'm going to leave.
One more. Solomon here. You.
I'm Don Corrigan.
Well, it seems to me that there's a common theme going on around here for the last three or four or five questions, which is how do you connect with the great world, you know? How do you not write a op-ed piece in the Missoulian which everybody reads and disregards an hour and a half later, you know, which is mostly what goes on, as we all admit, you know? But how do you get out? How do you connect? How do you write something that will really strike a nerve with a lot of people? And I have to say, I don't know. I never did it. You know? It's a little bit beyond me. But I will say that I think you ought to keep trying. And maybe some genius out there amongst you will figure out how. You know, every once in a while there is a great book of essays that connects. But it's generally about climbing Mount Everest or something, you know. It's hard to imagine an environmental book that would connect, except for Rachel Carson, as we said. So I don't know.
I feel connection a lot. I get a lot of letters, and I answer all the ones that don't seem psychotic. And, you know, I'm in my study. Day before yesterday, I get a call from a friend in Virginia who says there's a kid just turned 23 who finished the season playing for the Boston Red Sox, and he wanted my phone number. He wanted to talk. He'd read all my books, and so this kid is floating down the Bitterroot River by Darby, Montana, and I get a call, and we talked about baseball for an hour and a half. It was great, you know, and that's connecting. I've never had anybody so appreciate the fact that when I was in eighth grade, I hit 670, and then I played with some older kids and got hit by pitches and became afraid of the ball, and in ninth grade, I hit 270, so I'm the only person I know whose batting average dropped 400 points in 1 year, and this guy loved that, you know. He almost fell out of the boat. I don't know. I do feel connections. And it's like Bill's talking about the 30 to 50 people of your tribe. I mean, that's what feeds us. That's what keeps us going. When we reach beyond that, it's cool, but it's gravy. At that point, we ourselves are becoming a media event. When I tour my books, when I toured the Brothers K, I went to 35 cities. By the fifth night, I knew exactly when people would laugh. I knew exactly when people would cry. I was taking things that had come to me really close to my heart, and I was killing them. It was becoming stumping. And you just can't be a machine and be human at the same time. And media machines are not human. It's something else that's going on. You know, the cathode ray creates a trance, and people just sit there and stare at it, and they're imbibing something, but it's not humanity.
I was just going to say, David, one of the things I think we could do to connect. I remember watching Jim Harrison. You're talking about the great Jim Harrison in France, talking off the top of his head to an audience of maybe 2,000 people at a book fair in Saint-Malo, and it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant. Apparently, all those people in French who speak French could understand, you know, what he was saying in English. They thought it was brilliant. He's a great figure. We could find some more people like that who are actually capable of coming on and presenting a great persona and talking a different game than Rush Limbaugh or those kinds of people. In other words, the thing about television, I don't watch television. It's just goddamn silly, most of it. You know, everybody knows it. And films are worse, you know, particularly Hollywood films. They're just goddamn silly. And I'll shut up.
We got one very, very quickly, about 1 minute. Go ahead. Last question.
I'm waiting for the young people to wake up to the fact that what's happening in the world is an unauthorized taking. It's a theft. I don't know that that's a metaphor. That's a fact. But I'm waiting for students to be marching not to 350, but justice for all time. I think we have to switch our approach from light bulbs to real understanding of what's being done to the young people. And in regard to this gentleman's question, if laughter saves the young people from despair, then I'm all for it. We can't allow them to fall into hopelessness. And I think that that the laughing has a real role to play.
Bill, Dave?
most privileged society in the history of the world, us, right here, sitting in this room. You know, what do? The systems we develop are not going to continue working. That's real simple. You know, a system based on freeways from the suburbs to the downtown, like in Phoenix or Vegas or somewhere like that, 50 years, that's not going to work. We're going to be out of petroleum, for one thing, and they're going to be out of water, you know, for another thing. So, you know, we got to stop and take all this stuff seriously pretty quick here, strikes me. Everybody ever read James Howard Kunstler? You know those books about a world made by hand? It's coming, you know. A world in which the president is somewhere in Minneapolis, but nobody knows quite where. Thank you for me. Yeah,
I guess the only thing that I have to say to that is that there's a... It's overwhelming, but there's a lot of journalists with a lot of connections in this room, so I'm just going to say at one time, there's a basic absurdity, and everybody's common sense is being offended every day by the idea of corporate personhood. Yep. A corporation does not have a pulse, doesn't have a navel, it is not alive. Its standards are extremely deadly and extremely limited, and I think all of us and the young and every, Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest, says there's something like 3 million NGOs and nonprofits in the world. I think if every single one of them just puts on the front page, we need to remove corporate personhood. The playing field is so not level. And really, until that happens, we live in a totally absurd world. Everybody knows a corporation is not alive. And they can buy whatever the fuck they want in terms of the American mind. And so I just think that's a really serious issue that everyone needs to put
in the forefront. I want to echo that and say that the corporation, any of them, is the only person in America who's legally required to be as selfish as possible. You know, and that's true. It's against the law for them not to be as selfish as possible. And
if the definition of insanity is the absence of the ability to distinguish right from wrong, then corporations are psychopathic.
And on that blithe note, thank you guys for listening, and thank for the three of you.